This is Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Making Conversation Australian Composers Podcast. My name is Lisa Cheney, and in this episode, I speak to composer and vocal artist Lisa Young. We recorded this interview at her home studio in Victoria in late November 2016. One of the things you'll notice about Lisa's music is that it isn't your average contemporary art music. Rather, it's a stylistic melting pot thanks to her love for jazz harmonies, South Indian and African music. Lisa is a celebrated singer and vocal percussion artist, and also an associate lecturer and voice specialist at the Box Hill Institute. She runs two ensembles, the Lisa Young Quartet and Coco's Lunch, the ARIA-nominated all-female vocal group. Throughout this episode, you'll hear works Lisa Young composed for both these ensembles, in addition to stories surrounding her PhD, life as a musician, conical techniques, teaching, and her tips on maintaining mental well-being. So let's begin.
Hi, I'm Lisa Young. I'm a singer and a performer and a composer and also a conical artist, which is South Indian vocal percussion.
Hi Lisa, thank you for having me.
Hi Lisa.
It's so wonderful to be here. Firstly, this space is beautiful.
I'm a bit spoiled, aren't I? It's a great studio.
I want to live here with you. This is fantastic. For those that are listening at home, can you describe the space a little bit?
Well, I live in Warrandyte, which is in the northeast of Melbourne, so it's in the hills. And this space was originally built as an art gallery for the painter who lived in this house before we were here. And so when we bought the house, it's a really large room with a wooden floor that's set up high in the trees. And so you look out into the valley and it has sort of like wooden shutters and it's just perfect for creating in and singing in.
Mm. It's beautiful. And we can even hear some birds in the
background.
Yeah, we can. Gorgeous. So you've had an incredible career and very inspiring to read about. One that I feel that I'm only really scratching the surface of when I read something like your biography. So your primary instrument is voice as a singer and improviser.
Yeah.
And in your music making, you connect a lot of world music and jazz together.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Great, tick for one.
Yep.
There's a huge influence of, or a passionate love for Indian music and African music.
Yep. So with South Indian music, I've studied that for over 20 years now, both here and in Australia. And whenever I've been able to study African music with Niteti Tete or various people that have come in different music styles into my life, I've studied it. It's still something I'd like to study more, yeah. The Indian music is the one I've really studied in depth. But I just love the calling voice and the way that African music works orally, that it really matches me, my aesthetic, yeah.
Wonderful. You recently completed your PhD.
I did.
That's fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah.
What was the topic of your...
The topic was creating with conical. So conical is the name for the rhythmic language of South Indian classical music and dance. And it's a vocal style that I've incorporated in my works for a long time and studied for a long time, but I wanted to look at the way it is used in contemporary voice in performance. But so I looked at the way it's integrated into my own work, but what I was really interested in looking at is how it's often thought of as being like a pedagogical tool for learning all the rhythms of South Indian music because all the percussionists learn that. But it's actually an extremely creative tool that once you've learned this music, you think in it, you improvise in it, and you compose in it. So that was what a lot of what I wrote. Like, so I created a large work for my PhD, which was the Eternal Pulse song cycle for my jazz quartet, and that integrated Kunukul into my sort of vocal sound bank, and I created like a, you know, song cycle or an album. And in that, though, I guess maybe what is more distinctive in the way I use Kunukul is that I use it as a language for melody and riffs and improvisation. So not just the tarigirdum, ta kadin, that's more an intoned sense, or as I might go, put it as the language for a melody, which is not a South Indian tradition at all. It's
okay.
Yeah, they wouldn't use it like that. So, and but my teachers are all always been really encouraging and kind of excited by that, actually, that they've sort of going, you invented this kind of thing of doing this like this. And for me, it was just a natural progression as a singer. And I could sort of hear, I think, the scope for it in choral music and in my own music, where I love language and I love expressing songs in words, but yeah, I could hear how it would really work well. Syllabus, really, of rhythmic language to expand your sense of how rhythm can work.
Absolutely, yeah, and a very kinesthetic way of approaching and feeling and embodying rhythms, even before actually getting into notation, which can be, as we know as composers, one of the things that is a barrier. It's where you stop, you know, the fluid creative process has to stop for you to pick up a pencil or open a file on your computer.
I absolutely agree. And I think I'm a big lover of oral traditions, like the Indian tradition and the African. They're all done by ear. And actually in the 90s as well, I was in the Bulgarian choir in Melbourne. There was a Bulgarian women's choir called Petrunka, run by Bagriana Popov, who's an expert in Bulgarian traditional songs, and that also was taught by ear, and great harmonic. It had a big influence on me harmonically, because they use lots of seconds and fourths and lots of tension in the harmony. It's still some of the best vocal music you'll ever sing. It's just really clever three-part writing for female voices. Just, I still teach some of those songs in my university choirs, you know, just as a different color, a different placement of the voice, trying to make singers realise if we try to go for that, it's a very different colour than what we would use, you know, in another style. But I really agree with you that the bit of paper, to me, it's a great memory device. But often in workshops, I'll teach it as much as possible by ear, because then people look at you, they have to work their ears, they don't go into a sort of... sheet music can send a lot of people into a panic as well, because they might not be really good at sight reading. So I find you get a really fast result and a great listening across a group of people if you don't use a chart. And I, of course, at uni I do use charts once we work on a major piece, and then it's really useful. But, initially in that coming together of a group, I don't find it useful to give out a bit of paper.
So that's a real, like, that leads me to an interesting thought of how do you feel working a lot of the time? I know that you write down your scores, especially in a PhD context and as a as an archive and memory device, but how do you feel the music that you're making fits in with what's known as contemporary classical art music, as it stands with a focus and the priorities on, you know, a beautifully articulate, incredibly detailed score, which then is given to the performer to interpret. Is it a conflicting space at all for you? Do you feel in, out, other?
For me, in my choral works, it's notated as a score, but in my jazz works, it's not. It's a map. It's just a chart. So it has, like, a lead chart. It has the melody and the chords and, you know, some directions in terms of sectional repeats, codas, maybe some as a different set of chords for soloing sometimes, but they're really different in that when I write for jazz quartet, it's in many ways much easier because I don't have to write four complete parts that works or five like I do for Coco's Lunch. And I take it to those players knowing that they will interpret it incredibly. And in that quartet, we've played together a long time. So, you know, there's a real shared understanding of what we're trying to make together as an ensemble. But I do, in that way, the quartet's music has a very jazz aesthetic, even though it's really an improvised aesthetic that everyone will bring their understanding of that language to the music. Whereas in the choral things I write, like with other plans, like I did just send that to the choir with a bit of an MP3 of me speaking about how to interpret the language, and it didn't need much polishing when I saw them, you know, a while later at a workshop I went to. It's very translatable. But as to where it sits in the world, I think for me, it's even really interesting for you to say, oh, you know, you've had such an amazing career or whatever. For me, I'm just in it every day and it doesn't really exist, if you know what I mean. Like, I don't really think about myself in that way. It's only every now and again when someone says something like that, you go, oh, yeah, I am a composer, aren't I? And actually, I have more recently had a feeling of, yes, I do have a body of work and there has been a progression and, you know, the influence of Kunukul particularly is very present and all of that. But I think when you're in it, you're just in it.
As a composer, your main body of work thus far, please correct me if I'm wrong, is for voice and for choir and for the Lisa Young Quartet?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that's my main body of work. You know, both of those groups have made numerous albums that have recorded definitive versions, so, shall we say.
We're now going to listen to Lisa's work for choir called Other Plans. It was written for the Australian Voices and released on their 2012 album, conducted by Gordon Hamilton. But I'll let Lisa do the introductions.
This piece is called Other Plans. It was commissioned by the Australian Voices Choir. So it originally was written in SATB format and had a whole life with them. And then in recent years, I transposed it and flipped the bass part up and just put it into a different key for Coco's Lunch and expanded the ending section. So I did a bit of a Kunukul solo at the end. And it's also one of all my choral pieces, one of my absolute favourites that, yeah, I just feel like it encapsulated something. Interestingly, in this piece, the melody, there's a melody section that comes from a song from my quartet's repertoire called The Moon Has Made Other Plans. So that's where the title comes from, that it borrows that melody, and so then it was just called Other Plans. But it does come from that thought of that you think your life's going in one direction, but the moon pulled it in another way.
Hey.
I'd love to go back now and learn a little bit about where did you grow up?
I grew up in Melbourne. I grew up in Oakley, and I went to, from year nine, I went to like a progressive school called Huntingdale Tech that had a very sort of free program, but it wasn't that it had a strong music department, but it had a strong drama department. So we put on there was a lot of people who sang and played, and lots of rock operas and that sort of thing. Yeah, that was fun.
Wow.
It wasn't a really formal education. There were, you know, quite big holes in it, I think, in some ways. But on the other hand, was able to just find my uniqueness, I guess, in, yeah. I just look at, though, education today, it's very different to what I had. But everyone would look at that in the same way, I'm sure.
How old were you, I mean, that you can remember that you started to sing and to play?
I grew up in a really musical family. My sister played keyboard. My dad was a drummer, and he played like in a reception band. And my mum sang, and then in her later years, she played the trombone.
That's so fabulous.
In the Oakley City Brass Band. And my mum's family were Welsh, so my grandmother was a lovely singer. And my dad's mother and father also, my grandmother played piano and his father sang. He was like a tenor sort of singer. So there was a lot of music and a lot of just playing at home, you know, a lot of like sort of we had a band really, like dad played drums, my sister played keyboard and I sang. So lots of parties, lots of singing. And mum was pretty theatrical in her own way. I think she was really, she missed her opportunity really to be a performer. I think she should have been. But yeah, so I was very, and also I was a dancer as a child. So I did a lot of loads and loads and loads of dance. And I think that informed my musical rhythmic internalization of rhythm.
How interesting.
Yeah, I think it influenced me quite a lot. Yeah. And so then I took up guitar and played guitar, and then that led to songwriting, really.
And how old were you, or do you remember the first song or piece that you wrote?
Yeah, I do remember the first piece I wrote. Oh, I probably didn't start writing till I was about 18 or something like that, you know. It was a very different time. And so I sort of developed a repertoire, solo repertoire, and then had a couple of little folky trios, and I did a lot of that, really. And then once I sort of discovered jazz more, then I kind of switched, you know, put the guitar down and started to play with incredible players and developed that sense, a larger vocabulary for harmony and things like that.
Did you have any formal training in jazz?
Only in lots of lessons, and then I got into masters as with my industry experience and my reputation.
Great.
Yeah. So I was, you know, I had lots of formal lessons in terms of voice and guitar, and then just played with great players and learnt fast. Yeah. It's just how it worked, really. And I filled in the gaps on the way, you know.
Mm. Yeah, often the most rewarding journeys are the ones that don't follow a standard.
Yeah, very rewarding. Yeah.
At what point did your interest in South Indian and African music start to emerge on your journey?
I started learning first with the African music. It was more that it was part of the a cappella scene that was growing through the 90s and the next decade or so. So that just sort of grew slowly. And then I did some work, Coco's did some work with Niteti Tete, and he plays a slata, was these ball things that you swing around. So once I saw him play those, I went, I need to play. You know, so just, you know, being what I was drawn to.
Mm.
Whereas with the Indian music, in 1994, I started to learn with Namatar Ravichandra in Melbourne to study South Indian rags. So I started to learn from her, and then after I'd been learning from her for a while, I heard the kunukul in the other room, like Ravi was teaching, her husband was teaching the drummers and going dariradun da and correcting in kunukul, and I was sort of going, I think I need to learn that too. So I started to learn both, and then in 1997, I was lucky to get an AsiaLink residency to go to Mumbai. So So there was a connection there that helped linked me with a teacher, and I learned from Dhanashri Pandit Rai for 2 months intensively in Mumbai. And because I was going to India, Ravi said to me, if you're going to India, you should go and meet Karagudimani in Chennai, because I'd been learning some of his pieces. So whilst I was in Mumbai or Bombay, whatever you want to call it, Mumbai is the new name, I went to visit him. And so, but that was a really intense, in fact, I'd go back and do that tomorrow, really go and learn some more intensively like that, because it was so fantastic.
As Lisa and I talked more about her experience and her love for infusing conical techniques in her music, it got me thinking, what does a vocal artist, someone who writes so much choral music and vocal music, do without standard text?
I think the best way for me to answer that question is to maybe just talk about the development of the Eternal Pulse work, the song cycle, which was written for my quartet. And initially I thought it would have lyrics as well as vocal sound banks. So I think of my sort of vocal sound bank world as conical is incorporated in that now, along with scat sounds. So if we know that that's a given. So there'll be some scat sounds and some conical, and I thought there would be some lyrics at some point. But I just worked from a rhythmic base of knowing that I wanted to include as many of the Carnatic-based rhythms as possible, so like different subdivisions, really. And also I wanted to have a more of a West African 12-8 in there as well, because I really love sixes and 12s. So, and I feel that they lead my mind in a different way, sort of polyrhythmically. So I knew I would want that. So then I was looking for a sort of story in the cycle of the piece, that it would go on a journey. So, but I didn't really define what that was. I mean, I did write a poem that is on the album cover that talks about sort of that ancient sense of rhythm and how it resounds. But lots of those pieces were just written over time and evolved over time, and I just had a big folder, really, that I would keep stashing all the ideas, and when I had good ones, I'd go, okay, I'm really going to develop this one. So looking at different, so, you know, one piece is in 7, one's in 5, one's in 12-8, one's in 6, and the ballady one is in 4, and then there's a conical piece at the end which has metric switches and things like that in it. So yeah, then I use my sense of jazz harmony and looking for strong melodies, and just really I think I pretty much work intuitively. So then I would create, refine, reflect, create, refine, reflect. Sometimes I just put my recorder on and I might just improvise, you know, using a drone, using aslatuas for the rhythm. And actually the Internal Pulse was written like that. I wrote lots of it just with me and Aslata was singing it, and then Ben and I harmonised it together. And in that first piece, in the opening piece, the idea was that it would be set in 12-8, but it would use a sense of 2, 3 and then 4. So sort of the zum dum da 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 dwe dum dum du da da dwe dum dum du da da dwe is over it and do it and da. So like that's really accenting a 2 feel. Then ah um btum be a da bu da 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 dum bae, like that's more of a 3. Then there's a bit when it goes or the zada, yeah, there's those long bits that have a 3 as well. And then towards the end, the zum dum da 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 dwe dum dum du da da dwe dum dum du da da dwe is over it and do it and da, like the more African 4. So compositionally, that was a directive on the score. You know, this is a sub 2 feel, this is a sub 3 feel, this is a sub 4 feel at different points, you know. And that was a big intention in how I was writing it. But, you know, I took a long time with the melody and all of that as well too. So fantastic. They just evolve, slowly evolve.
Wonderful. Would you like to very shortly introduce the internal pulse?
Well, this is the opening track. And I think of all the compositions that I've ever written, it's one of my most favourite, actually.
Recording came from the Eternal Pulse album performed by the Lisa Young Quartet, recorded, mixed, and mastered by Hayden Buxton. The next question comes from our project patron, Cameron Lamb. He's a composer and also director of Kammerklang. What outside of music most inspires you and your work?
I guess there's just sort of a life force in general that inspires me, and I need to pay attention to it. Like it's like I need to give it time in my week and not always just be teaching or working, which I really love. But I know that if I don't spend time in my studio, it's not that it goes away, but it doesn't bear fruit unless I just regularly visit it. So I really try as much as possible, particularly in the mornings, to have time in this room. And then it really feels then like things get delivered, if you know what I mean. So for me, it's about having an openness, and it's also about protecting my own energy too. Like I'm not a really big party person or anything. I'm careful where I spend time, what I spend time, who I spend time with. I really need nature, and so yeah, I need really good like air, nature, hiking, walking, and yoga. I do quite a bit of yoga, and if I could, I would become a yogi. That's on the back burner too. I would really love to do even more of that, because I feel it really affects my well-being. Just I want to be physically really well for a long time. So, and yeah, of course I'm inspired by podcasts that I listen to.
And what do you listen to?
I listen to Tara Brach a lot. She runs the Insight Meditation Center in Washington. Philip Adams and Wally Daly and those sort of people just talking about the world. So to not be ignorant about what's going on in the world, because I do find that I can't really watch the news. I find it too negative and too depressing. Whereas I find if I listen to people like that speaking and interviewing people, I get a much deeper sense of what's going on in the world.
I think this is an absolutely wonderful checklist and advice for maintaining and nurturing mental health in a field that is, quite challenging and very rewarding, but very up and down and at times quite unstable. So I'm personally going to re-listen to this checklist later. Mental note to self to listen to all these things. And those podcasts sound fantastic. So my very last question, and I think this is a nice one to go out on, is do you have any advice for young composers or composers just starting out?
I think my advice is just be true to yourself, to know who you are, be good at what you're good at, be masterful at what comes naturally to you, and work really hard on the rest. So if you know that these are your strengths, really play to them, and then go, I really need to work on this, this, and this, and attend to those things that need work. If you have the opportunity to compose for a group that is performing regularly, then that try to make connections in that way. Like if you're not in the group yourself, but if there is a group that, if you wanted to write choral music, say if you found a choir that would perform your works, then write to the job. Don't make it too hard and too difficult, because you have to write things people want to play. And I think the other thing is to be generous to other people, that there is plenty of room in the world for us all. So even though the funding opportunities might be less or whatever, be really clear with your vision when you go for some funding, and the clearer you are, the more chance you'll have of getting it, I believe. And also sometimes you get opportunities and sometimes you don't, and generally it works out. But you know, try to develop your own unique voice, whatever that is. And if you're living in Australia, it's Australian. So one of the things in Australia is we don't have a whole lot of fixed traditions that we've grown up with. It's very different for many of us. So in many ways, we're free to be who we are. And yeah, try to be true to that.
That's wonderful advice. Well, thank you so much, Lisa Young. This has been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks, Lisa.
We're very grateful to the Australian Voices and to Lisa Young for the permission to use the recordings in this episode. If you'd like to learn more about Lisa Young, about the Lisa Young Quartet or Coco's Lunch, visit her website, lisayoungmusic.com.
Thanks for listening.
The Making Conversation podcast is brought to you by Making Waves. Making Waves is a free online listening resource bringing listeners the latest new music from Australian composers. We'd love for you to discover, listen, like, subscribe, and share new Australian music. You can find us at makingwavesnewmusic.com. We'd like to thank all the people who made this season possible. This includes the supporters of our crowdfunding campaign, project patron Cameron Lamb of Camaclang, and Creative Partnerships Australia's match funding program. The series production team is Leah Blankendahl, Stephanie Eslake, Sasha Kelly, David John Lang, Matthew Lorenzen, Rebecca Aaron-Smith, Chris Williams, Antonia Zappia, Daniel Thorpe, Thomas Green, Lisa Cheney and Peggy Pelias, along with interns Angus Baxter, Malena Radice and Mark Wolfe. The podcast theme music was the work I/O by Australian composer Elia Simic-Prozic. If you wish to learn more about the composer, music or interviewer featured in this episode, head to our website and click podcast to view the show notes. If you're enjoying these podcasts from Making Waves, there are a number of ways in which you can show your support. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or your favourite app. You might even like to leave a review. You can also share this episode and the series with your networks. Making Waves is a voluntary endeavour. If you're interested in volunteering or interning with us, we'd love to hear from you. We also encourage you to consider making a small one-off or continuing donation to support the ongoing promotion of new Australian music and composers. Visit makingwavesnewmusic.com/support.